This is EG's Jess Harold, and I'm talking today with one of the leading planning lawyers in the field, Richard Harwood QC. I've known Richard professionally for longer than either of us likely wants to work out, having spent many years at the High Court regularly harassing him for skeleton arguments, from when he was a young barrister right up to and after he took Silk in 2013. Right from the start, he was courteous and helpful, which, sadly, is not always the case. Richard is joint head of chambers at 39 Essex Chambers, has been involved in a string of high-profile planning cases over the years, has written extensively on the topic, and in 2014, he was awarded an OBE for services to planning and environmental law decision-making. And now he's here talking to me. Richard, it's a great pleasure to speak to you.
Jess, thank you very much for asking me along. And I remember emailing many skeleton arguments over to you over the years, and I hope that some of them were an interesting read.
Certainly. Well, I think you were quite pioneering in that move of moving to actually emailing them over as opposed to letting me photocopy them, which saved a lot of time when you introduced that innovation. So I think we'll come to take a more detailed look at your career, but I have to ask first, what has it been like being a planning barrister in 2020, and how has the pandemic affected your work?
It's been quite strange, and I think we were all sort of looking post the general election and post Brexit to getting a little bit of normality. Mm. And then everything changed. I mean, for chambers, we kept the building open. We had a skeleton staff in initially, and we've been building up the numbers on the staff side. Most barristers were working from home, but that's then sort of started coming back to a degree. And in terms of individual practices, on the first day of lockdown, I spent the whole day doing a telephone hearing on a substantive judicial review, which is something that would never have been done previously. That went actually very well. We had a judge who understood what was going on. So the court moved over to virtual working very quickly, particularly the High Court, who did it well. But I think the big impacts on planning work in the adverse sense were that the planning inspectorate shut down hearings and inquiries and examination hearings. And only after quite a bit of effort, I'm sure we'll come to that, did they start getting those back. Mm. Yeah. And also, my sense was that the big projects took a bit of a pause for a while, a couple of months, whilst people were seeing, could we actually go on to the next stage, spend a fair bit more money doing that. And then it's taken a little while for that all to get going again.
And with the, what have your experiences been as video hearings have become the norm? I mean, what difference do you think it's making to the procedure? And do you think there'll be lasting changes as a result of this?
I think it's gone well. I've been involved simply in audio hearings, but quite a lot of colleagues have been doing video hearings. And the judiciary adapted very, very quickly to that. And got pretty relaxed in some respects. So on one video hearing, there was a problem from one of our senior silks logging in. He didn't think that he was online, swore very noticeably. His junior was busy WhatsApping him saying, "We can all hear you." At which point he apologised. And the judge, who not notoriously a relaxed judge, took it all in very good humour. So there's been a willingness to get going. The judges, clerks in the High Court have done a brilliant job of making these virtual hearings work. But that is quite sort of labour intensive. And as the county court has had far more difficulties achieving that. One change that has come in has been the use of electronic bundles for the filing of court proceedings and also being used in the hearings, and that will be an innovation which I think will keep us going forward into the future. I'm sure there will be more virtual hearings than there would have been once we're back post COVID, whenever that is, and the days of paper bundles and paper bundles of authority, as you'll have seen those. So it comes in a lever arch file and first are about six pages during the course of the day. They won't have the lever arch file any longer. It's all going to be on an iPad. So there are some real benefits, not least for trees.
which obviously fits in well in planning and environmental law. And obviously another thing is that you represent clients from all over the country who in the typical course of events are often having to travel great distances, sometimes all the way down to London or to one of their local High Court centres. But something like, you know, virtual hearings are going, if they continue to be part of the process going forward, it's going to reduce an awful lot of that, isn't it?
It'll reduce some travelling for the hearings. And what has been done on hearings is a team, even if it is geographically quite separate, usually to set up a WhatsApp group. So you're communicating during the hearing. And again, I think that's something which will stay even when we get back to physical hearings, because you see very well, in a physical hearing, something said by the judge or something said by the other side. And then you're all sort of looking around, what's the answer, trying to pass legible notes to each other. Well, we'll just be sort of discreetly tapping away to each other. Mm. And that helps sort of keep the appearance of panic reduced. So that sort of thing is going to follow through. The other thing which I think potentially can come through, both in the courts and also in the planning appeals system, and is happening on the local authority level, is the simple public accessibility to what's going on, the ability of the public to view proceedings of all those sorts, either at the time or subsequently. That's capable of helping immeasurably with public appreciation of what we all do and how decisions are reached, most importantly.
And one thing that I think the pandemic has demonstrated is quite how central planning is to our daily lives. And a key tenet of the government's COVID-19 response has been making changes to permitted development rights and use classes to allow for more flexible development to meet the various challenges posed by the crisis. I mean, how successful do you feel those measures have been so far?
I think in terms of the sort of immediate response measures, those have been quite successful, and government has been very sensitive, both in the ministry and also in Number 10, to what responses are necessary. So bringing in the takeaway provision in permitted development rights, whereas previously a lot of restaurants wouldn't have been allowed to do takeaways, that has helped keep some businesses going, extending time for implementation, which was a suggestion which was made quite quickly to government from various sources and has now come in, the changes to street table licensing. Those have all been quick and quite responsive measures in those terms. The broader approach to the changes on permitted development, the changes, radical changes to the use classes order, I think we'll have to see how that all works through within that process. But it's been a high degree of sensitivity. I think actually the biggest achievement of government in responding on the planning side to COVID were to bring in the virtual meeting regulations for local authorities. Mm-hmm. As previously, of course, local authority committees and the authorities themselves had to meet in person. Absolutely no way around on the legislation. That was quickly changed. And within really a matter of a week or two of the new regs, are coming in, and the regs only came in at the start of April, so they were done together in about a fortnight. Local authorities are holding virtual planning committee meetings, which have gone well in terms of decision making, gone well in terms of public participation. I've spoken at one of those quite early on, and I think have also hugely improved public understanding of the process, because far more people have viewed those meetings on YouTube than will conceivably have been in even a very full council chamber for a controversial planning application. So that's been the biggest success from the planning side, has been allowing the planning committee system to continue to operate.
And as with the court system, it seems likely that innovations like that will continue beyond the pandemic and become how things operate going forward.
To a degree, I think there's a a huge advantage in the in-person hearings on, say, the operation of a committee. To some extent, and it's the same, it goes the same with meetings, it's that sort of discussion outside the formal businesses, the council seeing the officers and so on. And you don't replicate that with a virtual meeting, but a sort of hybridization where things are recorded and broadcast, some people are coming in electronically, will make a huge difference. And that has potentially a huge saving on the arbitration side for quite early on into the crisis. In Chambers, we were involved in a arbitration which involved participants in seven different jurisdictions, a whole variety of time zones, arbitrators in different places. That was all done virtually, and that all worked. So there's a lot of useful flexibility. I think there's an important role in terms of sort of physical hearings when it can be done, but there'll be hybridization in various ways within that process to help make it work.
Returning to those permitted development rights and use class changes that make it easier to change office development into residential and to build, you know, upwards on residential development, do you think there are risks, there are dangers in making the planning system too flexible, that it could lead to inconsistency and threatens the quality of development?
I think there's always that degree of danger. It's a question, I think, of the extent of control. Mm. But we do have to recognise that town centres in particular are going to change, will continue to change. And in a sense, on retailing, you need a reason other than actual shopping to come in to a retail area. So there's a question of how far that goes. And then I think we're into quite a complicated battle in terms of permitted development rights and the way in which that is evolved from obviously previously being rather sort of formal, you've got the right or you haven't, to more and more layers of complexity on prior approval because of the difficulties created in some of the office to resi conversions, which are pretty poor quality. I've been involved in a lot of office to resi conversions, which have been very good quality, partly because ultimately someone has to be paying money to live there. But there have been those problems. So we now have a rather sort of hybrid process, which is rather between permitted development as you normally see it and a planning application. There's a lot of issues which need addressing on prior approval. In the context of actually some very complex rules, a couple of days ago I was looking at the new provisions for putting extra flats on top of block of flats and grappling with that definition. What's a block of flats in circumstances you've got several buildings which have a connected large basement car park and there's some office development on a related part of the scheme? Through quite a lot of fun topics relatively late at night when I was looking at it. So we are going to be working through a lot of disputes about where those provisions actually apply, with the scope of them, as well as the planning merits issues which still need to be resolved.
Well, there's been plenty of what is a flat cases heard over the years, so I'm sure we'll see plenty of litigation relating to the limits of these provisions. And it's emerged that the government is going to face a judicial review challenge to its new rules on permitted development from, I think, the Community Action, the Rights Community Action Campaign Group. Have you any thoughts on how that challenge might fare?
I'm not involved in that one and not looked at the detail of it. I think there's an EIA point that's been taken, which seems to be in principle a rather difficult point to make on general legislation. And there's an inequalities point, which clearly is relevant to any secondary legislation. But again, how that one will play out, we will see in future,
I'm sure it's must be one of the cases to watch for the towards the end of the year, I imagine, in your industry.
Yes, if it's depends on the result. I mean, if it doesn't succeed, then it's probably not going to say anything ultimately of great import. But if it does, it will have a number of consequences, obviously.
And looking further ahead on the planning reform side, the government has promised to build as part of the UK's response, part of its comeback from the economic effects of the pandemic. What do you make of the proposals in the planning white paper? And do you think they will actually bring about improvements in the planning system?
I think there are some good thoughts in those. It's a paper that's actually less radical than it's presenting itself. And so I think the nature of planning reform is that just about every planning reform is trumpeted as the biggest reform of the planning system since 1947, when invariably any planning reform is the biggest planning reform since the last lot of planning reform. I do think it is as radical as it would like to portray itself. It's not a zoning system. It's a move to simplification. And you can see easily enough, I think, where the roots of it are. Some of that are in various papers, for example, the policy exchange papers, which were produced earlier this year. Some of it is in the work of the local plans expert group, which I and other people were involved in 2015, 2016. And some of our recommendations were implemented at that stage. Some of them were given a little bit of a mixed response and rather stayed on the back burner. And a number of those have made it into the white paper in essentially that form, particularly a question of timetabling of local plans, to say that rather as we have with development consent orders or infrastructure decisions, you actually have a firm statutory timetable which says, well, get on with it. And one of the difficulties with the planning system, too often it's on the local plans and it's on often big applications rather than the more run-of-the-mill stuff, is a lack of an imperative to get on with it and actually make decisions. And if that can be changed, that would be quite a useful innovation.
So beyond that, if you had carte blanche to reform the system for the future, I mean, what aspects of the current system do you think are working well, and where would you focus your reforms?
I think it's actually on a simplification process. And where we do have a bit of a problem and a bit of clutter is that quite often government has sort of looked at ways of getting round the planning application process by finding some other way of getting its consent. And I think there are about 19 different mechanisms in the legislation, most of which are just not used. There are quite a lot of bits of sort of fiddles and sort of shifts within the system which were brought in for one reason or another, which again just make life a little bit more complicated. So it is trying to simplify. I think a key thing in practical terms is trying to get a proper measure on the material which is prepared and submitted. And partly that's the local plan stage. Strategic environmental assessment, I don't think has worked terribly well. The reports are not very useful. And that needs addressing. There's always a question on planning applications as to what needs reporting on at the right level of detail and, let's face it, the right level of delay and the right level of cost, which flows with that, and what you can actually sort of get on with. Now, that's sort of day-to-day sorting out stuff, but I think it's the day-to-day sorting out which is key to getting the right decisions through in a fairly quick time.
So moving on from reforms for the future to looking at how things are working in the present, you mentioned the Planning Inspectorate shut down its decision making early in lockdown. What's the situation on the ground now?
I think there's been quite an improvement after quite a lot of pressure, including my impression is ministerial pressure. The inspectorate realised that it needs to get back in holding hearings virtually quickly rather than spending a long time thinking about doing that. So there's been a steady resumption since May. The position we're in at the moment is that the hearings are back. They may not be virtually. There are some physical inquiries which are programmed in, and the experience has been that the virtual hearings have run very well. It's all been doable. This technology has worked, and people have been operating far more electronically in terms of the amount of papers being used and so on. So that is proving to be an effective process. It's probably not overall as convenient a process as getting everybody in the same room, but it is something which is working, and now the inspectorate has caught up, well, it's in the process at least of trying to catch up from a couple of lost months in terms of hearings. Though obviously decision writing was still taking place.
And obviously site visits are an important aspect of many planning appeals. How is that working at the moment?
That seems to be back on. The site visits in large part had sort of shut down right at the start of the crisis, and part of getting the system back up and running was a willingness to actually carry out site visits. And there's no real difficulty in those being done in a socially distant manner. So that, I think, has not turned out to be terribly problematical once the determination was there to get back and get functioning.
And turning to the legal side, you and four other colleagues set up the Planning and Environment Group at 39 Essex Chambers back in 2002, but it has expanded to become a 42-strong planning, environment and property group now with 13 silks. Does that growth, that success, does that reflect the growth and development in planning advocacy as a whole over that time, do you think?
Not really in terms of the overall planning system. It's grown through a mix of lateral recruitments, so plenty of both big silks and SAR juniors, so people like Peter Illich, John Steele, Paul Stinchcombe, having joined the team, and also growth through our own pupils, our own recruitment in chambers. So we're a civil set. We operate at the top end of all the civil work, and what we've been able to do is to add planning and environment and property to that, and very recently we've strengthened the property team with David Sawtell and Nira Moda joining us. So we've added to our pure sort of property offering, and that's helps us in both directions, the planning and environment side, and helps us on the property side.
A sort of a cohesive approach to the overall picture. Now, we mentioned how one of the, possibly the major problem with the planning system is it can be slow, and it can be quite complicated to understand. And I imagine that for many developers in particular, and even perhaps for some local authorities and Secretary of State, that planning challenges, which inevitably cause further delays to development, must be a source of frustration, shall we say. And that this frustration may at times be vented on people in your position, on planning barristers who are, you know, putting forward arguments on behalf of those who object to development or to certain decisions that have been made. How do you seek to get across the fundamental importance of judicial review as part of the planning process?
Well, I think where it's critical is in enabling decisions to be made properly and fairly. So it's getting the decisions right, or at least made within the right framework. And that is critical for the development industry as much as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That they may legally sound that policies have an identified meaning or applied consistently. I have to sort of have in mind that when it comes to challenges to inspectorate appeal decisions, the majority of those challenges do seem to come from developers. So it's getting the right framework for decision making, and also it's getting a decision in a way which has public acceptability to it, which is, it's a process that's done fairly. It looks like there's a consistency in approach, and the High Court procedures are achieving that, not actually so much from each case or many cases being subject to that scrutiny, but because the way the system quite rightly operates is that proper reports are made to committees, there's a decent amount of analysis, material is made available, ultimately the appeal stage inspectors look at things carefully, do reasoned reports. So a very small number of planning decisions which are subject to legal challenge. So at the local authority level, the figures are hard to make that much of a sense of, but there's about 250 planning judicial reviews a year, and most of those will be challenges to the grant of planning permission by a local authority. Local district councils in England grant about 380,000 planning permissions a year. So the proportion of planning permissions which are subject to legal challenge is an absolute fraction of that, possibly approaching 1 in 2,000. And the proportion of big schemes that are subject to challenge is still going to be extremely low. So the way the legal process works, it helps sort out those cases, but it also sets the ground rules for how decision making is taken. So just give an example of a case I was doing this year called Holborn Studios, where I was acting for the largest photographic studio in Europe, who are based in Hackney. And their site is subject to redevelopment proposals, which, whilst intended to keep sort of light industrial studio type use there amongst residential, and not suitable for the sort of studio facility we have. And we've ended up two High Court challenges to that. One a few years ago, which established the potential need for consultation on amendments to planning applications. And this year, a case which has led to the High Court saying that viability assessments need to be published and made available. And also established, oddly, for the first time it's come up, that there is a right to of the public and developers and anybody else to lobby councillors, that they can write to the members of the committee, because the committee were under the belief that they couldn't actually read anything which had been sent directly to them. So those are decisions which affect process. They affect process in Hackney. They affect process across the country. Those are decisions which seem to me to be ones which help decision making, get better decision making, and also get more publicly acceptable decision making. And that's important. It's important that when decisions are reached, whether it's by local authorities or it's inspectors or it's by the courts, it's done in a way that even if people don't like the outcome, they at least come away thinking, well, it's been looked at carefully, properly, we've had a chance to have our say. And one aspect of the relatively low level challenges to inspector decisions, only about 1% of inspector decisions get challenged in the High Court, or even smaller challenges to local authority decisions, is that the quality of decision making is such that even though there are usually going to be quite a lot of people who don't like the result, in the main, people will think that actually it's been gone about in the right way. We've had our go, we've not succeeded, but let's just move on, rather than being sort of resentful of the outcome and how they were being treated.
Is that one of the more difficult aspects of the job, when you, if you have a client who doesn't take that view, who thinks it's all been unfair because it hasn't ended the way they wanted it to?
It can be too good, but I think it becomes a matter of, particularly if you're looking at the legal challenge side of it, of explaining to the client, whether it's a developer or it's a third party, well, this is the limits of where the court will be interested in operating. Mm-hmm. And so what's been happening. But I think when you're looking at a legal issue, and of course we can argue about procedure, we can argue about interpretation of policies, we can argue about legitimate expectation and all those public law concepts, at the heart of a successful challenge to a decision is the ability to say, well, something has gone wrong in how this decision has been reached. And when I'm looking at a case, I'm trying to think from just trying to stand back, drop the technical language, has something gone wrong here? Mm. And usually where something has gone wrong in a legal sense, the lay client and the other participants can see that and think about it in non-technical mm-hmm. language. And so those things do tend to align. And it also, I think it's really ultimately the way judges work. Judges are there to deliver justice, to get what seems to be the just outcome. Mm-hmm. And if they think a decision-making process has gone wrong, then they will find a legal error which brings it down. If they think, well, whether or not that's the view they would have taken on the merits, trying to form a view on the merits, they think, well, actually, look, it's a perfectly sound decision-making process, we can understand why the inspector reached that conclusion, then the court will actually be quite reluctant to find that there's been a legal defect, mm-hmm. Or a legal defect which is at least as fatal to that particular decision.
Yeah, that obviously it's an area where passions can run high, can't it? Can't with clients who perhaps, you know, you quite frequently get groups of locals who've banded together to oppose, say, you know, an incinerator or some other kind of development, which is typically nobody wants in their backyard. I imagine it for some people it must be more difficult to see the dispute in those terms of whether a decision has been fair or not, and you know you must get some people who just don't want that development where it has been put forward.
Well, quite a few people who don't want the outcome, but I think the tendency is for challenges to be brought where mm-hmm. there is a reasonable prospect of that. And I think developers are actually more likely to have a go at a not so good challenge than a group of locals who, even though there is cost protection, will have to put together a reasonable amount of money one way or another towards bringing that. So there isn't that sort of forlorn hope challenge perhaps quite as much as might be sort of seen on that. There's usually something that's sort of to be said for a challenge, even if it's if it ultimately is going to fail.
Now, you were first called back in 1993, and I imagine you've seen many major changes during that time, but one of the most fundamental must have been the creation of the Specialist Planning Court in 2014. The figures suggest that since the inception of the Planning Court, the speed of first instance hearings and judgments has at least increased. So how successful do you think the Planning Court has been in making justice more efficient and cost effective?
I think it's been successful, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the judges tend to be specialists. So either full-time High Court judges who, whether or not they dealt with planning in practice, have built up an expertise in it, or deputy judges who tend to be experience on the planning side. And that's quite important. You may recall back around sort of 2011, there was a great concern about delays in the administrative court, and particularly a concern on delays on planning cases. And at that stage, quite often, if you're challenging an inspector's decision, you sort of file the proceedings. There's no requirement for permission to proceed at that point on inspector challenges. A year later, the case will come on for hearing. You try and remember what it was all about. So there were great delays. The courts tried to deal with that by throwing a lot of judges in to deal with that, many of whom did not have experience of planning, and some of them without any real experience of public law. And I think a lot of the judgments were a little more surprising than you'd have on the run of it. So we've got specialist judges, which help. We have a dedicated timetable for the significant cases, which do mean that even where permission has been granted to proceed, you will get to a substantive hearing within 6 months of the commencement of the proceedings. And things can be brought on quicker if need be. Another change has been that on the Section 288 applications, the challenges to secretary or inspector's decisions, it was previously the position, before permission had to be granted, that the Secretary of State and any OM that was defending the decision did not have to produce any defence or statement of case setting out what their case was. So quite often, you, from a claimant's perspective, you bring the proceedings. No evidence in reality needs to go in from the Secretary of State's side usually. And so the first you know what the Secretary of State's arguments are when you see their skeleton about 2 weeks before the hearing. There's now light judicial review because there's permission stage. The Secretary of State and other responders' reasons need to be produced at a very early stage, and that does make a more informed analysis. So that is working pretty well in those terms. I think we still have issues with delays in getting Court of Appeal hearings on.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the High Court is moving at a good pace.
Yes. I think for those cases that go, you know, to the Court of Appeal and even then further on to the Supreme Court, it can still take a very long time. I mean, do you think there is anything that can be done about that?
I think it becomes, particularly for the Court of Appeal, a question of judicial manpower, bearing in mind all the other pressures which those courts have on them. And I think what's important is to try and get particularly permission decisions from the Court of Appeal, whether the case can proceed, taken speedily. And sometimes they are taken very speedily. Sometimes you do slightly wonder where the file ended up on doing that, and then to get hearings in. And the Court of Appeal has been under a lot of pressure with the pandemic that it has been had reduced capacity to take virtual hearings, but the court was looking quite carefully at what cases needed to get brought on and what cases could get pushed back to deal with those.
Understandably, the majority of cases are sort of finally resolved by the planning court. Do you think that in the 6 years it's been in operation, that there's been an improvement in the quality of advocacy before the court and the quality of judicial decision making?
I think judicial decision making is probably sort of helped by greater experience. But I think has always been strong. And the nature of High Court judgments, and particularly actually on a, say, you have a substantive hearing in front of something like the Planning Court, is that the judges will have made an effort to pre-read. They don't always necessarily get that much time to do it, but certainly considerable pains to understand what the case is all about. And some will do that quicker than others, but will always seek to do that. So ultimately, the quality of what comes out is pretty good. I think inevitably there are different ways different judges will deal with things, different conclusions they will reach. But of course, remembering that from the concept of any sort of advocacy, that you have somebody coming in independently to resolve a dispute between at least two people who are putting forward what they see as being at least arguments which have got a chance of succeeding. And in that situation, there ought to be some degree of unpredictability about what the outcome should be, because otherwise nobody would be spending their time trying to have to argue about it. So you've got those degrees of tests. As far as the quality of the advocacy goes, I'm not sure that that's whether that's sort of changed much at all. It is, I think, a good quality of advocacy, and to my mind, one of the things about being in practice is you're always learning. You're always listening to how the other side is doing. And when I'm in court, I quite often like to be sort of thinking in the back of my mind, well, if I was for that other party, would I be presenting the case in the same way? How's my opponent done it? What result have they achieved? Have they actually sort of, because of the way they've done it, or done it better than perhaps I might have done? And is this something to sort of pick up with the future? It's a nature of a job which is always about learning, something about law or learning about how to do it. And I think you have to be very open to sort of seeing how that's done. Developing your own skills whilst you're going through it. And I like to think I'm continuing to do that.
Is the judicial side of things something that interests you at all?
I'm busy enough with plenty of other things at the moment. And it's a huge judicial workload which is sort of taken on, and what's impressive is seeing the quality of colleagues going onto the bench. So in chambers we've had Alison Foster and Justine Thornton joining the High Court bench in the last year or so. And a number of High Court announcements today. There's a very high quality of the High Court bench, which is good to see.
And on the caseload side, this year you've had possibly one of the most colourful cases of your career, certainly factually, that the Supreme Court gave judgment in May, the case of Dill. Where you finally persuaded the Supreme Court unanimously, no less, that the removal of a very large pair of urns should not require listed building consent after previous courts had found against you. I mean, is that one of the most interesting cases you've ever tackled?
It is a good, interesting case. And I've done quite a lot of art law work, particularly coming out of the heritage side of it. So what had happened was that Marcus Dill had inherited ultimately with the house a pair of lead urns from the early 18th century on pedestals, and those were sold at auction in 2009. That's before the internet was quite as sophisticated records as it is now. Nobody appreciated that these had been listed as listed buildings in their own right back in the 1980s, and a very odd listing, because the urns had been moving around with the family from various properties since 1939. It's always been seen as chattels. Anyway, about 5 years after the sale, the local authority notices that they've gone, and Marcus faces a listed building enforcement notice, and we were seeking to argue in that appeal, amongst other things, that the urns weren't buildings. The listed building is a building on this one. So when they're not buildings, therefore, notwithstanding on the list, they're not listed buildings, so there's no breach. And it's one of those cases where we get the sort of the shock of the planning inspector taking entirely his own point to say, well, they're on the list, so I can't consider whether or not they're buildings. That's the end of that point. And we end up, right, High Court. High Court agree with the inspector. Court of Appeal agree with the inspector. In particular frustrations. It's one of those cases where we're absolutely satisfied that we're right on the argument. So it's even more frustrating when things don't go right. And we got permission from the Supreme Court to appeal to the Supreme Court, had the argument in March just before lockdown and judgment in May. And the Supreme Court agreed with us on the two critical points. First of all, that because in this case, Marcus Dill was being subject to the consequence, and potentially the criminal consequences of this public law decision, he was able to challenge that within the planning process. So it's a reaffirmation of the right of the citizen to challenge decisions which directly affect them as a defence to potential proceedings. And then the court dealt with the question of what is a building, listed building purposes. And whilst not ruling whether or not these urns were a listed building, they set out the tests for the first time that that's been done, and dealt with very clearly. And also gave a few steers. So Lord Carmel kept referring to the urns as vases. And the court made very clear at the end that given that Marcus Dill has basically spent 5 years trying to get an answer to the question as to whether or not these were listed buildings, and he should have been given that answer early on by the inspector, it was really sort of quite wrong for the proceedings against him to continue. And subsequently, the local authorities have withdrawn the list of building enforcement notice.
Okay.
So it's an interesting case. It's an interesting case in the law. It's one of those cases which sort of had Supreme Court written all over it from a very early stage. But also in terms of, in a sense, the determination that's needed by the client and sometimes by the legal teams as well to pursue a case which you're satisfied is right, and you just want to get in front of the tribunal which says, well, yes, you are right.
It must feel like winning a cup final with a goal in the last minute or something.
It's a nice feeling to have, and also it's one of the enjoyable bits, particularly of High Court and appellate advocacy. Beyond that is the way in which the advocacy is not sort of written out speeches or wild declamations, but it's a conversation with the judges. You're having a conversation, whether it's with one judge or three or with five, and being tested on the points, and you're responding to how they're putting it. And one of the very enjoyable forms of advocacy, I think, is having that interchange, that conversation with a judicial panel.
We at EG, we Sarah and I, we put together our top 10 cases of the year each year, and I think Dill is rather nailed on to be included, so look forward to that at the end of the year. So looking further back over the years, I mean, what would you list as some of your other proudest moments in court, your greatest hits, as it were?
Well, I think one of those was acting for the government on the Thames Tideway Tunnel, the super sewer scheme, which was subject to four judicial review challenges, and took the approach of trying to get those knocked out at the permission stage. And we got all of those knocked out in a two-day permission hearing, so one case after another, effectively, in front of Mr. Justice Ouseley. So got that scheme sort of cleared through the courts pretty fast. I think the other general sort of element of those cases is where you're sort of running an interesting point. I mean, you're after trying to get a result for the client in all cases, and nobody runs a case simply because of the point of law, and you run a case which has got a, there's a potentially interesting point of law, but the facts aren't terribly attractive, then the likelihood is the court's going to find against you. So the interesting points of law come out of the facts. But been in a series of cases where there've been quite dramatic legal developments coming out of those. One was concerning the Mitchells Brewery site in Lancaster, and until this particular bit of litigation, 2011, most demolition, if it didn't involve residential buildings, was not subject to planning control. And the argument I put for Save Britain's Heritage was that, well, that was a breach of the Environmental Impact Assessment Directive, because if you don't have a need for planning consent at all, even permitted development, then you can't consider whether you need environmental impact assessment. And therefore, the exemption from planning control for widespread demolition was unlawful. And we, nature of the things, lost in the High Court and then won in the Court of Appeal. And an outcome of that has been that a whole swathe of demolitions are brought within planning control. Doesn't mean they're stopped at all, but it does mean that there's an ability to better control those. So some decisions do, in cases you're involved in, do actually end up changing the way in which the system still operates.
Yeah.
And as we discussed earlier on, that I think is part of the role of judicial review. It's to get the planning process in this case, or whatever the process is, operating properly, fairly and effectively. And ultimately, if government doesn't like what the courts say about how the process should operate, then it can change the policy, or it can change secondary legislation, or it can use an act of parliament to turn things around. But generally speaking, the way in which the courts say it should operate, if it's a bit different from the way it's been done, government goes along with. And when you look at the legislation you're applying, it's actually the, usually in judicial review cases, it's the courts saying, well, actually, decision making should follow what Parliament or what government has said it should do. It's bringing it into line with government intentions.
And you mentioned Hoban Studios earlier on. What else can you tell us about your the rest of your recent and current caseload?
It's nice to be doing, and I always do a whole mix of matters. So some very major new settlement or urban regeneration schemes, which I'm acting for developers on. The New Eastern Villages projects in Swindon, which is a whole series of as it says, new villages, but about 12,000 properties, lots of development as well. And that's thrown up a series of matters, big planning inquiry, compulsory purchase, a case called Symmetry, which deals with the question to what extent planning conditions can require highways to be provided within a site. And that is a case which from the council we won in the High Court and is in the Court of Appeal shortly. So some of it's the very big projects. Some is dealing out with small issues. So this week I've been dealing with an enforcement problem for a developer which had shut down the operations on the site, and remarkably we've managed to get a notice withdrawn within 48 hours. So, and hopefully things can now get back onto an even keel. So it's sorting out problems, and some of those are big ones, but you have to look to think always, what is a client want? What are we trying to achieve?
And in addition to all that, you've authored Historic Environment Law in 2012, Planning Permission in 2016, Planning Enforcement, third edition in 2020. You've co-authored Planning Policy with Victoria Hutton in 2018. And you have for 20 years been a case editor of the Journal of Planning Law. It sounds like that is a side of your work that you very much enjoy.
It is. There's an enjoyment in, I find at least, an enjoyment in writing. It helps helps me understand it. It's a way of having a note somewhere of the cases you always wish you could remember but don't. And that sense of explaining it, and sort of the case commentary is looking at an interesting angle to it. So that all I think is of assistance, and it's something to do on trains as well.
Trains, I think I vaguely remember traveling on those. So one thing I don't think I knew before, and I only sort of discovered when looking into your background, is we actually come from quite similar areas. We come from not far apart. You from Shirebrook, a village in Derbyshire, which I guess on the Nottinghamshire border.
It is near
Mansfield, and I'm not far away. I was from Gainsborough in Lincolnshire, so similarly rural. Yeah. Do you think sort of growing up with that background in a rural area, and I believe your father was involved in coal mining, do you think that's shaped your approach to your career?
I think my grandfathers were coal miners. My father started off as a mine surveyor, but then became a water engineer. Mm-hmm. I think everyone sees a mix and comes with ideas about areas and their background, and it's always important to have in mind that there are lots of different parts of this country and lots of different attitudes and issues that need dealing with, that's an area which was almost entirely dependent upon coal mining, and in the 1990s that ended, so we're looking at regeneration in those sorts of localities.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, when you aren't busy with planning cases and writing and authoring textbooks, I gather your commitments are largely as a football parent, is that right?
Yes, having sort of spent probably about sort of 45 years not paying a great deal of attention to team sports, not doing it terribly well. I now have football mad children who are not only busy watching it, but more particularly they're busy playing it. So I'm seen to spend sort of most of the weekends watching one of the boys or watching my daughter playing football.
Mm-hmm. And are you gaining an appreciation of the beautiful game through that?
I am, although I sort of I think I appreciate sort of sufficient ignorance that I'm not one of those parents who tries to sort of coach their child as to how to do it, and their skills are vastly in excess of anything which I could imagine.
Well, long may that continue. Thanks very much for joining me, Richard. And fingers crossed we'll actually see each other in person in court before too long.
I certainly hope so. Thank you very much, Jess. Thank you.